Hello, welcome to the Positive Energy Podcast. I'm your host, Ian T.D. Thompson. The Positive Energy Podcast is the official podcast of the University of Ottawa's Positive Energy Initiative. The initiative seeks to strengthen public confidence in Canadian energy policy, regulation, and decision-making through evidence-based research and analysis, engagement, and recommendations for action. Today on the program, we are talking with Dwayne Bratt, Professor and Chair of the Department of Economics, Justice, and Policy Studies at Mount Royal University. In November of 2015, then Alberta Premier Rachel Notley announced the Climate Leadership Plan, an ambitious plan to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the oil-driven province. The plan was said to bring together key stakeholders from industry, Indigenous communities, and environmental groups, as well as influence the direction of the federal government's own climate plan. While elements of the plan have since been dismantled by the United Conservative Party, the influence of the plan has persisted. To talk more about the Climate Leadership Plan and its legacy is Professor Dwayne Bratt. Dwayne Bratt is Professor and Chair of the Department of Economics, Justice, and Policy Studies at Mount Royal University. He is also the author of a new case study examining the Climate Leadership Plan. This study will be published by Positive Energy in the first quarter of 2020. Dwayne, thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning, Ian.
As a more national-focused initiative, some listeners may not know the background or the history of the Alberta CLP. Can you describe to the listeners what the Climate Leadership Plan was?
Well, before we discuss the introduction of the Climate Leadership Plan in 2015, I've got to go take a step back and talk a bit about the history of Alberta, because only with that context do you understand how radical the CLP was in Alberta. So from 1971 to 2015, Alberta was governed by one province, the Progressive Conservative Party of Alberta. And so you saw a switch in government for the first time in 44 years. So that was very remarkable. In addition, the PCs, when they won in 71, replaced another conservative party, the Social Credit Party of Alberta. So you would really have to look back to the 1930s to see the first time that we had a non-conservative government in power in Alberta. So the election of May of 2015 is the real catalyst here. In addition, as your listeners will know, Alberta is the centerpiece of the oil and gas sector in Canada. Yes, there is some in Saskatchewan. There's a little bit in Manitoba. There's some in Newfoundland. But over 80% of oil and gas production is in Alberta. And previous conservative governments had been very reluctant to take measures on climate change. Former Alberta Premier Ralph Klein used to dismiss greenhouse gases as just, you know, dinosaur farts. And they were they fought back against Kyoto. They fought back against any measure dealing with climate. And so when you have the Notley government come in 2015, and you see the change in government for the first time in 44 years, there was an opportunity to do something about the environment. There was a sense that Alberta's reputation was an international pariah. It was one of the reasons that Canada would get, you know, the Fossil of the Day awards at the various climate meetings. There were protests when Alberta premiers, whether it was Ed Stelmach or Alison Redford, showed up in Washington. It contributed to Obama vetoing the Keystone XL pipeline that would take oil from Alberta all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. And so for a variety of reasons, dealing with greenhouse gas emissions, dealing with repairing Alberta's international reputation, the Notley government decided very quickly to move in the direction of climate leadership.
I think that paints a really great picture, and I'm glad that you mentioned just the absolute ambitiousness of the plan, especially in contrast to the past climate policies and the rhetoric of these conservative governments. And one of your experts you interviewed stated that the NDP inherited a bit of a climate pariah.
Yeah.
Now, I just want to talk a little bit more about that aspect, as well as what did exist prior to the CLP. Can you describe to the listeners a little bit about those climate policies that existed prior to the CLP?
Really, there was one climate policy, and that was introduced by the Ed Stelmach government in around 2008, 2009, and it was a tax on high emitters in the oil sands. And it was the proceeds of that were to go into green energy projects. There was some that was dedicated to carbon capture and storage. But it was a very weak system. The Ecofiscal Commission showed just how weak that system was, and that it was really seen not as a way of lowering emission intensities in the oil sands, nor was it about generating revenue that could then be put into green technology. It was designed to be a public relations piece that the government could point to when critics came and said, you're doing nothing about climate. And so this high emitter tax is what was introduced, but it was filled with holes. And so when Notley comes in, the day that she does a number of things, but when she announces a panel to look at climate change action, she immediately raises the high emitter tax from what the Stelmach people had up to $30 a ton. And so it was a sign that this government meant business.
Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that you mentioned the panel, because I just want to talk a little bit about the climate leadership plan and the design of the actual plan itself. In your report, you refer to the public and the private approaches taken by the government, the public being this climate change advisory panel led by Andrew Leach, providing a series of policy measures to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But then you also have the private, and this was through endorsement of several discussions that were taking place between industry leaders and environmental NGOs. How did these two streams lead to the formation of what was to become the Climate Leadership Plan?
So they were very different streams. So let's take them in order. So the public stream was a high-profile panel led by Andrew Leach, who is an energy economist at the University of Alberta. And they convinced him to chair this panel to look at all options on the table. And Leach had written about energy policy and climate policy for a number of years. And they conducted public hearings in Calgary, and they conducted public hearings in Edmonton and in Fort McMurray. And they also had technical sessions. And that is really where the economy-wide carbon tax initiative came out. This is where the coal phase-out came out. This is where the methane reduction came out. But there was a separate path, and the separate path was absolutely critical, and it was unknown that this separate path was occurring until the big press conference in November of 2015. And in fact, even at that time, it wasn't known the extent of these private conversations until much later. These private conversations actually begin under the previous Conservative Premier, Jim Prentice. Jim Prentice had been a federal environment minister. He'd been a federal industry minister. He comes back, he wins the leadership and becomes Premier of Alberta in August of 2014. He recognizes that Alberta needs to do something on climate. He had the credibility in both the oil sector and the environmental sector and the indigenous sector. This was a man who could walk into the Petroleum Club and be given respect, or a man who could go to a Greenpeace meeting and be given respect. And so he decided to convene these quiet dinners between oil sands CEOs and the leaders of environmental groups. And there wasn't negotiations, it was just a set of conversations and to get to know one another and to understand each other's position. And gradually these conversations got lengthier. And when Notley comes in and the public panel occurs, they realize that something is going to be happening and that they need to be part of it. And it was there that the emissions cap came in, putting a cap on overall greenhouse gas emissions at 100 megatons in the oil sands was agreed to by both the oil companies and the environmental groups. And so when they had this massive press conference in November of 2015, that was really a bit of shock and awe. Normally, when you have a public panel, you know, maybe the responsible minister, in this case, Shannon Phillips, the environment minister, would introduce Andrew Leach. Andrew Leach would outline his report. Maybe Phillips would come back and say, yes, we're taking this recommendation, this recommendation, this recommendation. We're going forward. Instead, you have this massive stage presence of environmental leaders, indigenous chiefs, the premier of the province, and industry CEOs. In particular, when Murray Edwards, one of the most prominent, the CEO of Canadian Natural Resources Limited, showed up on stage, there was an audible gasp in the crowd that he was endorsing, you know, a climate plan and was endorsing an NDP initiative. And so you couldn't have had that press conference if the private meetings weren't being held simultaneous to the public consultation.
Mm-hmm. What I'm taking away from this, you have these discussions taking place, and there isn't necessarily full 100% agreement, but there is discussions taking place, and I think that's incredibly important. In your view, why was it important for the government to pursue both this public approach as well as continue the private approach taking place regarding their climate policies?
Because I think you needed public buy-in, and not just public buy-in by public opinion, but you needed buy-in by the key sectors of the economy. If you're going to make a series of radical changes to energy policy in this province, you better have some of the energy companies on side. And if you're going to develop a major environmental plan, you better have the environmental people on side as well. So I think it was important. But what it shows, I think, is when you're going to make a big policy change, you need a window of opportunity. And that occurs when the government changes. So that allows Notley some space to do this. But it also required work at both the public level and at the elite level to get this through. And so in one sense, there's some continuation. The people I spoke to said if Jim Prentice had won the 2015 election, Alberta would have had some sort of climate plan. The question is, what would it have looked like and how would it have been done? But Prentice didn't win. So it's the counterfactual. Notley did win. She continued with these discussions that were occurring between the CEOs and environmental groups. But she also conducted this public panel, and it was the recommendations that flowed out of two of those that led to what we eventually saw in the Climate Leadership Plan.
I want to talk a little bit about, you mentioned the announcement of the Climate Leadership Plan, how it created this media sensation of all of these major stakeholders coming to the table and supporting the initiatives by the government. What can decision makers learn from the Climate Leadership Plan and the stakeholder engagement that was taking place?
Oh, and that's why this project was chosen. Because if you were to sit back and think about in the abstract how you would want to develop a major policy initiative in the area of energy and climate, this is the way that you would do it, right? You would have the provincial government working with industry, working with environmental groups, working with Indigenous people, having public consultations and submissions and technical briefings and bringing everybody together at the end. And so there's a lot to be learned from this, and there's also a lot to be learned from what happens next. And the story is not as rosy as the beginning is. The other is there were some real time pressures placed on the Notley government. There was the Paris Climate Summit, and Notley was going. She knew, based on previous summits and Alberta's reputation at the time, that she needed to show up with something. Likewise, the reason it was on a Sunday afternoon is because Justin Trudeau has just been recently elected in October of 2015, and he has called a first minister's meeting on climate on the following Monday. And once again, Notley needs to bring something to that first minister's meeting. And so what Alberta did is not just become a leader in its own province. By the nature of walking into a first minister's meeting with a package of policies, everybody else was having to respond to Alberta's initiative. You know, what are you going to do in Manitoba? What are you going to do in Ontario, you know, to match what Alberta has done, as opposed to previous first minister's meeting where Alberta seemed to be on the sidelines and was defensive. So there were some time pressures that led to this occurring.
Yeah, there's a little bit of proactivity engaged. And your report, you referenced the fact that the CLP and one of the goals of the CLP was to hopefully change the reputation of Alberta from that of a climate villain to that of a climate champion.
Yeah.
And in your view, do you think this was achieved? I know that's a complicated question.
It was very temporarily, mm-hmm. and there's no doubt that the people in Paris and the people around the rest of Canada took notice of what Alberta was introducing. Each of the policies on their own was not necessarily unique. BC had already introduced an economy-wide carbon tax, for example. Ontario had already phased out coal. But it was the package of all of these things all at once. So the coal phase out, the carbon tax, the methane reduction, the emissions cap, and the legacy of what Alberta had been like prior. That's what made this so revolutionary. Not that if it was just one piece or another, it was the package of proposals and in the jurisdiction it was being introduced in. That's what made it remarkable.
So we're hinting at the conclusion of the story a little bit about how aspects of it were achieved, but it wasn't perfect. And your report outlines multiple reasons for the backlash of the plan and why the carbon tax in its form failed in the province. There's the
So a backlash emerges pretty quickly from the opposition Conservative Party. So at this time, there's two Conservative parties. There is the Progressive Conservative Party, who had, as I said, governed Alberta for 44 years, but they're in a bit of disarray. Jim Prentice resigns on election night. There's some floor crossings, some retirements, a death. And so the PCs become smaller and smaller. Instead, you have the growth of the Wild Rose Party, and the Wild Rose Party is an even more conservative party. They become the leader of the opposition, and Brian Jean attacks the plan almost from day one, and basically says that it's a tax on everything, that the NDP never campaigned on a carbon tax. And so while there's many aspects to this, and the coal phase out was a very big issue in one town, in particular the town of Hanna, by and large it was the opposition to the carbon tax. And what then happens is Jason Kenney leaves federal politics, comes back to Alberta, and he merges the Progressive Conservative Party and the Wild Rose Party into one, the United Conservative Party. He, too, takes up the mantle on the carbon tax and pounds the Notley government repeatedly on the carbon tax, and he wins a majority government largely on this in April of 2019. Bill 1 is the repealing of the carbon tax. They do that very quickly, and the moment that it gets proclaimed into law and gets royal assent, they stop collecting the tax. So it happens very rapidly, and that they focused on the carbon tax. I will say the rest of the climate leadership plan remains in place, although the methane reduction is hurt by the removal of the carbon tax. But that becomes the big story, is the removal of the carbon tax. And so within less than 4 years, it's created and it disappears in this province.
Mm-hmm. There's a few elements to what you just mentioned that I kind of want to stick into a little bit. So firstly is just the backlash. And you do say there are multiple reasons for the backlash. Some of it is just Alberta's anti-tax sentiment, the importance of oil and gas for its economy and for its jobs. Did the NDP adequately consider this context when it was presenting its plan? And additionally, knowing this context, was the CLP doomed from the start?
Oh, I don't think so. I don't think it was doomed from the start. Yes, there is anti-tax sentiment in Alberta. For example, there is no provincial sales tax, which is why Jean and others use the language of, well, this is a de facto sales tax. Yes, the oil and gas sector is important here, but they had buy-in from some pretty senior officials, Steve Williams, Murray Edwards, etc., on this. I think what was more damaging was the recession, and I don't think in the fall of 2015 there was a realization, and I don't know how there could have been a realization, just how deep and long-lasting that recession would be. So here we are in 2019. There's been at least, 150,000 jobs lost, which is massive in a jurisdiction of just over 4 million. And so this recession and the introduction of a tax in the midst of a recession was really difficult to reconcile. Likewise, there were some series of events that just could not have been foreseen. The election of John Horgan in British Columbia and the BC election that led to BC opposition to the Trans Mountain Pipeline, which wouldn't have occurred under the previous Liberal government of Christy Clark. The election of Donald Trump. Yes, the election of Donald Trump led to the approval of the Keystone XL pipeline, but had Hillary Clinton won, I think Alberta would have been much more on side with Clinton's climate agenda than with Trump's climate agenda. And so those external events, I think, also hurt the Notley government. The Trans Mountain Pipeline in particular, as we're getting closer and closer to the 2019 election, the narrative that the NDP has is that carbon taxes were necessary for social license to get pipelines built. And it became part of this grand bargain to repair Alberta's reputation, to get groups to support market access. But the BC government is fighting market access. Indigenous communities in British Columbia are fighting market access. And the failure to get the Trans Mountain Pipeline built, I think, was the final nail in the coffin for Notley. So these are all external events. Similar to the Trudeau government, there was an alliance, a partnership between the Trudeau government and the Notley government on climate. But when Trudeau introduces Bill C-69 and Bill C-48, it creates a backlash in Alberta, and Notley gets partially blamed for that. But there was one thing that the NDP did, besides these external events, that contributed to the death of the CLP, and that was their messaging. The NDP did some great work in the lead-up to that press conference. The public path, the private path, the big press conference, the great show in Paris, the great show in Ottawa, all these kudos, they're on a wave. But they couldn't successfully message that. And so in the spring of 2016, they decided to take out a large ad campaign. And the ad campaign not only didn't convince Albertans of the benefits of this carbon tax, it actually backfired. And there's public opinion polling that showed that the more that people saw the ad, the less they liked it. And it just seemed out of touch with Alberta. There was a famous clip of a woman growing grass on her roof and watering her roof. And it's just like, this makes absolutely no sense in Alberta. And it baffled people. So the NDP messaging just, it wasn't there. It's like they put so much time and effort into the development of the policy and not enough on the implementation of that policy.
Mm-hmm. And I'm really glad that you mentioned the communication, because that really struck me as well as something that surprised me. We have the success of its rollout. You have this great press conference. But then when you come to actually the implementation, the communication of why they are moving forward with a carbon tax, the issue became, or the communication of it became, quite muddled about what its effects and what its purpose actually were. Knowing what we know about the CLP, what can decision makers learn from it regarding the do's and don'ts of communicating or effectively communicating policy?
They need to look at the entire policy spectrum, right? So you've got agenda setting, you've got policy formulation. you've got the decision making. And I think on those three parts of the policy process, the NDP was pretty darn good on that. But the last two steps, the implementation and the evaluation, they hadn't looked ahead. They hadn't seen that there was still going to be opposition. And in fact, there was opposition within the oil and gas sector and within the environmental community. The people I interviewed made a clear distinction between the consensus that existed amongst people at the table, but no consensus by the people that weren't at the table. So environmentalists blasted the Pembina Institute and Ed Whittingham for being at the table and negotiating this emissions cap. Likewise, smaller oil sands companies or junior companies or even, you know, Imperial Oil or the Chinese state-owned enterprises that didn't participate, it blasted those that did. And so they never anticipated the range of opposition, which they probably should have, and how to counteract that. And they didn't realize that the introduction of a tax, even for climate purposes, even with a rebate program, was going to cause pushback. And so you need to look beyond the actual decision and the actual set of policies, and it's how are we going to implement them? Where are the fissures? Where is potential opposition going to come from? And start to think ahead. And because they were so rushed to do this, they simply didn't have time, I think, to go forward. The NDP was not expected to win the 2015 election. It was a surprise to them, as it's as much of a surprise to Albertans. So they didn't have all of this already set up. Likewise, you know, when they started the panel, they start the panel in June, and they've got to have it by the end of November. And then the Trudeau government moves that deadline up 10 days. And so they're time crunched to get everything through. And as Andrew Leach complained, you know, so he leads the panel. He goes, they introduce the report, and then the funding for the panel ends. So there's no communication strategy that was put forward. By the time they did a communication strategy, it was muddled, and it was a bit too late.
See, that's really interesting, you know, regarding just the rushness of it and the fact that, the funding ends the next day. At that point, you're not really focused on the implementation if the actual panel itself isn't necessarily involved with it.
Yeah, I mean, they thought the implementation was, all right, we'll bring in the tax on January 1st, 2017, and this is the set of regulations that we're going to change. And that's part of implementation. But the other part of implementation is responding to and understanding where criticism is going to come from and get the public on side. Because if you go back to the beginning of our conversation, this was a pretty radical shift for the province of Alberta. And so you need to have a clear set of messages as opposed to saying this tax is designed to change your behavior, but don't worry, it's a very small tax. Well, is that going to change your behavior or not?
You've been listening to the Positive Energy Podcast. Today's episode was produced by myself, Ian T.D. Thompson.